Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker. Daryl Steinberg is the 46th President pro tem of the California State Senate, a position he was elected to in August 2008. He was first elected to the Senate in 2006. His district includes the capital city of Sacramento, plus parts of Elk Grove, Citrus Heights, and Rancho Cordova. Steinberg's service to Californians has earned him numerous awards and citations, including the California Journal's prestigious Mini Award, which recognizes legislators who represent what they call a pattern of conduct and outlook and demeanor that exemplifies the best kind of public service. Let me tell you what our editorial page said about Senator Steinberg when he was selected as president, quoting myself. Steinberg is regarded by his colleagues as an ethical, serious, effective legislator who takes on important but neglected issues, mental health, foster care, the dropout rate, among many others. Steinberg also has a San Francisco connection. He was born here. He earned his BA in economics from UCLA and a JD from UC Davis Law School. Before he came to the legislature, he served on the Sacramento City Council from 1992 to 1988. Please join me in welcoming to the Commonwealth Club Senator Daryl Steinberg.
Thank you very, very much, John, for those kind words. I'm going to put them in a plaque and put them right on my desk, you know. It is wonderful to be with you tonight and to have my second opportunity to speak to the Commonwealth Club. Last time I was here was about a year and a half ago when I had the honor and the privilege to appear with Van Jones, who is now working directly in the Obama administration on an issue that is near and dear to my heart. How do we make climate change about more than just the environment? How do we make climate change about economic opportunity for all people, especially in our urban centers? So when I received this invitation some months ago now, I intended to come tonight to give a speech about all of my long-term goals and my vision holding this honorable position of President Pro Tem of the California State Senate. I came and prepared to talk to you about how we reform middle and high school education in California to end the 20% dropout rate in this state, how we better connect education to the economy, how we solve California's water crisis, how we lead the nation in developing the most aggressive renewable energy portfolio standard, how we become the nation's leader in moving towards universal access for healthcare, quality healthcare for all Californians. So that was going to be my speech, but I had second thoughts because I thought that on May the 14th here, 2009, 5 days before a very important special election in California, that I need to talk to you about California's fiscal situation, how we got here, and how we intend to get to the other end of this crisis so that I can, in fact, come back in 6 months or a year and give that speech about all the positive agendas we intend to create here in California. So here's my long, hard, sad story. I was elected, as John said, in August of 2008 to be the pro tem. And I took office in December 1st specifically, of 2008. And some might say that I drew the short straw here. Because the day I was sworn in, I immediately faced the single largest deficit in state history, $42 billion. And like anything that I've ever taken on in my life, I like a challenge. And, you know, as I told Carla Marinucci a few minutes ago, a mentor of mine, John Vasconcelos, once said to me that it is much more fun to serve during good times, but much more important to serve during the bad and difficult times. And so I took that to heart, and I recognized a couple of things about California and its governance. We have a system in this state that has built up over many decades that no longer works for the people. And I think that's very clear to the people. We have an outdated system of financing state government. Our state government, our local governments, and our school districts are terribly tangled up with one another in a way that essentially says the part of government that raises the money doesn't necessarily provide the services, and the entity that government that provides the services doesn't have the authority to raise revenue to meet whatever the public is really demanding for that level of service. And as a result, people, I think, have lost confidence in the ability of state government to essentially equate quality public services with a stable, ongoing system to pay for those public services. And there's a whole lot more. There is the gerrymandering of legislative districts. There's the excessive partisanship. There's term limits. There's the initiative process, which people love, but frankly is not the same initiative process that Hiram Johnson envisioned at the beginning of the 20th century. And yet, when I was sworn in on the 1st of December, I can honestly say that the largest reason for the magnitude of the deficit, we never had as large a deficit of $42 billion. Remember, our base budget in California 3 years ago was about $102 billion, was that California is really at the bottom of the hill as the national boulder titled recession and economic crisis is rolling downhill very, very fast. To give you some idea of the reasons why the number was so large, between July 1 of 2008, when this really started, and today, it is estimated that by the end of this fiscal year, we will have lost about $40 billion worth of our revenue because people don't have as much money. 11% unemployment rate. People aren't buying goods. Our sales tax are down. First time we've seen an actual drop in personal income tax revenue since the 1930s here in the great state of California. Everyone thought that we could not get the job done in December, January, and February because for 18 years in this state, there has been a logjam known as Republican unwillingness to consider the revenue side of the equation. We're one of three states, as you know, in the nation that requires a two-thirds supermajority vote to pass a budget. And that means that the minority party can responsibly or irresponsibly exercise its power to decide whether or not the budget gets passed on time and what it looks like. And Republicans signed pledges saying they weren't going to vote for taxes, period. Well, we were able over an eight-week period, given the magnitude of the problem, to actually craft a bipartisan $42 billion deficit reduction plan. $16.5 billion worth of cuts, $12.5 billion worth of taxes, and some very timely and helpful assistance from the federal economic stimulus funds with the new president and the new Congress. And in order to accomplish that, The two Republican leaders, Dave Cogdill and Mike Vallines, insisted, and from their perspective, I think rightfully, that if they were going to vote for taxes, they wanted some form of spending restraint that would possibly avoid California going through these up and down cycles in the future. So we negotiated Proposition 1A. And Proposition 1A, to some, is a spending cap, and to others is a responsible rainy day fund. I happen to think it's the latter. And I'm a progressive liberal Democrat. I was the author of Prop 63, the Mental Health Services Act. I've put my heart and soul into fighting for more resources for education, for foster kids, and for people who too often are forgotten in our society. But I believe Prop 1A is good policy because it doesn't do any good to the people we purport to serve to expand services in 1 year because we have a lot of money, only to then have to retract and take back that promise 3 or 4 years later and cut them, sometimes even deeper than from where they started, because we haven't put money away in a rainy day fund. And that's what Prop 1A does. And we said, and this is all very complicated, which is part of the problem. We said that, and the Republicans said, that we'll agree to 2 years of taxes, 2 years of taxes if Prop 1A fails. And if Prop 1A passes, we'll agree to 4 years of taxes. And the reason they did that is that they didn't want the Democratic constituencies to have a free shot at killing the spending restraint and not have any consequence on the length of the taxes. Prop 1B is a measure to pay back public education $9.3 billion that we're cutting from them. The people tell us that education is their most important priority. It's 50% of the budget. We had to cut it. But Prop 1B helps restore the funding over time as the economy improves. Prop 1C ain't the greatest policy in the world. I admit it. It's securitizing the lottery. It's basically taking the future proceeds from the lottery and getting a mortgage up front of $10 billion, five 1 year, five the next year, and using that to get through the rough times. That's not the greatest thing in the world to do. But it allowed us, at least in the short term, to avoid $5 billion worth of additional cuts. And then Prop 1D and 1E, we took from the reserves of the Children's Health Initiative, known as Prop 10, and then my own baby, Prop 63, the Mental Health Services Act, which I worked with people like my friend Saul Feldman, to help pass in 2004 to fulfill the three-decade-long promise that Ronald Reagan and the legislature made back in the 1960s when they shut state mental hospitals, that we would build a decent system of mental health treatment and help people get off the streets. And it's working, and it's working remarkably. So here I am, the leader, and I make a decision, not looking for any credit for it, but a sober, honest decision that said, do I take $225 million out of the Prop 63 reserves for 2 years, or do I cut 98,000 kids off cash assistance whose parents have exceeded the five-year work requirement? Do I cut tens of thousands of kids off of subsidized health care? Do we cut developmental services deeper than we ended up cutting them? We cut IHSS, in-home supportive services, $75 million. The Republicans wanted to cut IHSS $400 million. We didn't do that. So I felt that, and I've taken some hits for it, that as the leader, it wouldn't be right for me to say, cut all those programs for people who are equally vulnerable, but don't cut the thing that I worked so hard on and championed. So you've got five ballot measures, and then you have a sixth, which is the most popular measure, which says legislators shouldn't get pay raises when there's a deficit. And I'm shocked, but 80% of the people think that that's a good idea. So we performed, in my view, and I know I'm a little biased, but a bit of a minor miracle by getting Democrats and at least six Republicans, in fact, six Republicans, to vote for a $42 billion budget deficit and did arguably what the people have asked for us to do for a long time, which is to get out of your partisan corners, make difficult decisions, and solve the state's problems. We did it, and the measures go on the ballot. Now, the ballot measures, of course, have taken a lot of attention, rightfully so. It's a political campaign. They're interesting, they're controversial, and they're consequential because Prop 1A, for example, its passage would mean $25 billion worth of additional public investment because of the two additional years of taxes and the repayment of the $9.3 billion for public education. It's important. But something has changed over the last 2 weeks. And that is, these measures are now beginning to pale, frankly, in comparison to what has continued to happen with our state revenue. Since February 20th, remember, I gave you the whole time frame. I told you about a $40 billion drop in revenue in total when all is said and done. But since February 20th, the Department of Finance estimates, and there's nobody who's really disagreeing with it, our revenue has dropped another $12 billion. Twice as much as what we will lose if the ballot measures fail on Tuesday. And so we have these measures. They don't poll well. My view of it is twofold. And I may conclude with this, and then we can have a conversation. The reason the measures are not poll, there are many reasons. The people are, in fact, angry at us, and I think they have good reason. I think that we have an obligation to be more productive on behalf of the people, and we intend to be. I certainly intend to be as the leader. But you cannot make good news out of resolving a $42 billion deficit except the fact that you resolved it and resolved it responsibly. I'm proud, really, no matter what happens, that we avoided an economic catastrophe, which would have occurred had we not balanced the budget. State would have virtually shut down, and that boulder would have rolled harder and faster. We protected the social safety net, and we found a way to repay public education over time. Not bad for $42 billion. But we're not selling any good news to people. What we're really saying is vote for these so that things aren't worse. Well, that's a hard argument. And secondly, people have less money themselves. I understand the tax opposition. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. People have less money. 11% unemployment, high rate of foreclosures. People are worried. And they're telling us you need to do better with government and you need to do more with less. But there's this third reason. And this is sort of what I want to conclude with. And this is hard for a politician to talk about. But as much as the people have the absolute right to be angry with us, and as much as we will respect whatever verdict the people render on May the 19th, it may also be time for the people themselves to look in the mirror. Because I think as a state, we have been enablers for far too long. When you look at what has occurred over the past 30 years, post Prop 13 and post many of these propositions, we have patched up every state budget problem that has existed. And people simply do not believe, and maybe for very good reason, that anything really bad will in fact happen if these measures fail and we have to make $15 to $20 billion worth of actual cuts to education and health care and public safety, because they've told us and may tell us on Tuesday that they don't, in fact, want higher taxes. I don't envy President Obama's job. He's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. But he does have one advantage that we do not have in California. The federal government prints money. They will run this year nearly a $2 trillion deficit, and some of it for very good things. I commend the president. I think the economic stimulus package is absolutely necessary. But you don't read a lot about the federal deficit. You read rightfully about the economy. In California, we not only have a legal obligation to balance a budget, but if we don't, the bond markets, the lenders, the key economic agents shut down. And people lose work. And the economy spirals. And there are only two ways to do it. You cut or you raise taxes. And at some point, we are going to have, and maybe this is the opportunity post-May 19th, an intelligent conversation with the people of California around what they want, what we want, and how do we go about developing a stable, robust system for paying for what we say we want. While doing our part to make government more accountable and to make government more outcome-focused. What are we getting for the dollar? Last thing. Regardless of what occurs on May the 19th, we will wake up on May the 20th and we will get to work. No complaints, no rancor, no what ifs. I know I did the best I could. I think we did the best we could. We can always do better. And we will. We're going to wake up May 20th. We're going to solve the problem. And you will not read this year. This is a real prediction here. It will not be a long, hot summer in Sacramento. It will not be. We've met our constitutional deadline to pass a budget. For every month we wait, if we don't make the difficult choices and the difficult cuts early, the cuts only get deeper. If the cuts are 15% in June, they will be 30% by September. Because you lose value the longer you wait. And so we will not wait. We're going to get the job done. We're going to debate. We're going to try to continue to find ways to minimize the difficulty and the pain for people who most need government. But we're going to act and we're going to get the job done. I'm very happy to answer your questions. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg. You have certainly set the table for a good discussion with the audience, and they are certainly responding with questions, so let's get right to them.
Right to it.
Question number one. What is Sacramento's plan B when all the ballot measures on next week's election fail? Can we file for bankruptcy like the auto industry and just start fresh?
Well, I would only transpose the when with the if, because we're not giving up. You know, you fight to the very end. But we are certainly prepared for any scenario. We're not going to wake up Tuesday morning and say, oh, now what do we do? We already know what we're going to have to do. The deficit is $20 to $21 billion. We will immediately convene what's known as the Budget Conference Committee, lead legislators. They will begin meeting that very week, and we will set a very tight timeline to resolve that deficit. And in all probability, the bulk of the solution will be cuts. Now, the governor said today, we're not doing taxes under any circumstances. I'm not going to say that. Just as I didn't criticize his proposal to potentially sell some state assets, we need to keep everything as a possibility here. But I'm not going to lead as leader of one of the houses, and I think Speaker Bass feels the same. We're not going to lead with taxes, especially in the wake of May 19th. We're not going to come right out there and propose some new tax plan. We're going to first, I think, recognize that people have less money, and the first thing they expect us to do is to do better with the money that we have. But I guarantee you that there are not $20 billion of palatable cuts out there. There just aren't. Republicans themselves despite their rhetoric, will not stand by $20 billion worth of cuts. Because cuts aren't just the Health and Human Services or public education in urban California. Cuts are also the Department of Corrections. There's also the aid we give to local law enforcement. There's also local government. And there's a whole host of government, despite the rhetoric, that they will be loath to cut. And so there will be a remainder. Put it under the category of other solutions. And we will be deliberative and take some time to figure out how we put forward those other solutions in a way that does not result in $20 billion worth of cuts.
Senator Steinberg, you may enjoy the premise of this question a bit more. If Proposition 1A passes, now would that prevent the state from increasing revenues in the future, even if there are sufficient votes in the state legislature to raise taxes?
We're not looking to raise taxes. I mean, I know I'm before, you know, an audience here in San Francisco, and I could probably, you know, maybe get away with saying more taxes. But you know what? You see, here's the thing. I'm not for increased taxes. I'm just not for cutting the hell out of public education and health care. And the two go together. And so if the measures pass, will taxes be off the table? Probably not. But we're not going to lead with taxes. We're not going to come out there right away and suggest, well, we need to do this. I think that would be a failure. I think we need to cut as much as we can cut in a way that is palatable. And then there will be a remainder, however large that is. And then I think we can address the questions of revenue. But let me say another thing. I haven't used the R word once today, I don't think, which is the reform word. Rahm Emanuel says, never let a good crisis go to waste. Shame on us if we do not use this period of time to at least accomplish one of the myriad of needed reform measures here in California. And how about we start with our volatile tax structure? We're overly reliant on the personal income tax. We say we want to promote clean energy, and yet our tax system does not incentivize clean energy nor disincentivize dirty energy. We tax goods while the economy has moved to a service-based economy. All the models I've seen said you could lower the sales tax rate and expand it to services and still bring in more money while giving most people a tax break. I want to address one other thing, if I might jump free, because this is more part of the last question. It's really fundamental to the way I think. Because some on the left and the right talked about bankruptcy. That was the thing that some on the left and the right during this debate said, you know what, let it go off the cliff. Let it go off the cliff, because then if you're on the left, that'll show those right wingers that we were right. And the people will then decide, let's change the 2/3 supermajority, which we need to do, by the way, or let's increase taxes, or let's do X, Y, Z. And the right wing said, let it go off the cliff. That'll show the people that, you know, you can't live beyond your means. And, you know, that will serve as the great rallying cry to reduce government. And you know what? They're both wrong. I could abide by any argument in the world in terms of critique of what we did or what we will do. The one argument I will not abide by is that it would have been better to do nothing and to let the state go off the cliff. That would have been economic catastrophe. It would have been economic catastrophe. And, you know, I've come to believe that regardless of your politics, governing really in some ways is down the middle. It's the only way you get things done. And it's imperfect.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking tonight with Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg. I'm John Diaz, your moderator for tonight's session.
This isn't off the record. Just kidding.
Senator, there's no such thing when I'm in the room.
That's true. I know.
The audience member had a follow-up on the what you call the R-word reform. Do you believe the state is going to call a or should call a constitutional convention to address the two-thirds vote and other reforms? What do you see as the dangers and the benefits of a constitutional convention?
First of all, I'm very glad that the Bay Area Council has taken the lead on suggesting the possibility of a constitutional convention. Because if nothing else, it intensifies the debate and the discussion and hopefully the action around reform. But I hope that in the end it's not necessary, that we can ourselves as elected officials and as voters can grasp the opportunity ourselves and begin to put reform measures on the ballot. We shouldn't just wait for a constitutional convention. But it's important that business leaders and labor leaders and community leaders begin to say that, you know, if you won't fix it, we will try. But that's a message to me as leader that we better start at least seriously promoting changes to our tax structure, changes to the two-thirds, initiative reform, bringing government closer to the people, untangling the various levels of government. There is a danger to the Constitutional Convention. If it's not done right, well, there's two dangers. One, I'd say one is a danger and one is a challenge. The danger is that if it's too wide open, that it could be a forum for, let's just say, the extremes on all sides. I don't think we want a constitutional convention on a woman's right to choose. I certainly don't. I think that's well embedded in our state constitution. So I think that we need to make sure that it is focused on how to govern California and how to make California work again. And then secondly, the challenge is, who's to say that those who are part of a constitutional convention will have any better time resolving the genuine ideological differences that are a part of the problem? Is the Constitutional Convention going to resolve the issue of what the voter threshold should be for taxes or for new budget? Is the Constitutional Convention going to be able to resolve what level of government ought to provide what service? Maybe. And maybe a convention could do a better job than the elected officials who do have to run for election and have all these political pressures. But don't assume that delegates to a constitutional convention will be able to wrap it up in a day or a week or a month.
Absent a constitutional convention, let me follow up, Senator, on the suggestion that you made that there's really a need to have what you called an intelligent conversation with the people of California over what they want from government and how to set up a system to pay for it. First of all, how does that conversation come about? You know, who leads it? How does it happen? And secondly, how do you overcome the many voices, particularly those on talk radio, who seem determined that we don't have an intelligent conversation about issues?
Well, let me take the second part of the question first. That darn First Amendment. The radio talk show hosts. I don't have an answer to that, but I must tell you it is a debasing of the culture, as far as I'm concerned, and the debasing of intelligent conversation. This is how bad it is. And I'll probably now be, when I say this, I'll probably be the next target of these guys, but I don't really care. John and Ken in Los Angeles, the drive time radio talk show hosts, who are beating, they don't beat us up, Democrats, they beat up the Republicans who dare to govern. Remember, Mike Vallines and Dave Cogdill both got thrown out of leadership posts for voting for a compromise. And in part, you got these guys, John and Ken, who are not only threatening and in fact instigating recall efforts against the Republican members who voted for the taxes. One member of the Republican of the legislature with an R by his name is being threatened with recall because he did not support removing Mike Vallines, the Republican leader who voted for the taxes, from his leadership position. So every afternoon, these guys are inflaming the public. And for better or worse, I won't even make a – it's for worse, but I won't even make a value judgment on the Republican legislators on this. But they cower because they're afraid of being the next target. We have some of that on the left, but not nearly as vitriolic. And so, I don't know what we do except fight back. I mean, Prop 13 happened when people got angry. Why can't the people get angry the other way? I don't mean to repeal Prop 13, by the way, in its entirety. But, why can't there be a counterforce from the other side where the people say, we don't want to live through billions of dollars of cuts to public education. In fact, we want increased investment. We want you to solve that dropout rate. We want you to invest in greater technology in our public schools. We're tired of fees going up at the UC and the CSU. We want the University of California that we remember a generation ago. They have the stage, and for now they have the volume. What was the first question?
That was basically, how do you have that intelligent conversation? Who initiates it? How's it happen?
Well, I mean, it's interesting in politics these days. Certainly, the chief executive has the biggest microphone, right? I have a microphone, but not as large. The chief executive has the microphone, and so that is one way. But even a chief executive, even a popular one, I think has a difficult time breaking through the clutter that now sort of exists in our popular culture. But if you believe that the initiative process, as one example, has been used too often in ways to push back progress around issues that you feel strongly about, why can't it be used in the other direction? I mean, really. The only thing I know, really, is to be able to tee up, if you will, real debates among and for the public by taking the key questions of reform directly to them. And in fact, under our system of amending the Constitution, you have to do it that way. Now, we may lose next week. And so then you're out there saying, well, geez, you took this to the people and look what happened. But so what? Change doesn't happen overnight. You sometimes gotta get knocked around a couple of times. And then sometimes the timing, you plant the seed. And then the timing becomes right. So that I think our goal and our plan is to begin taking some of these key questions of changing this broken system back to the people. And we will eventually break through.
We have a number of audience questions that are also suggestions that might help you on getting to a balanced budget. Here's one. Why not just cut 10% across the board to balance the budget?
It's been tried before, actually. And what 10% across the board means is direct program cuts. And I say this respectfully to whoever asked the question and to the public. Cutting 10% across the board is a little bit of a cop-out because it doesn't force you to actually make priorities because nobody really knows what it is that means. What it means is that the agency, unelected department heads, will take that direction and then we'll decide which program to cut and which program not to cut. And we, the people's representatives, will not have been engaged in the process of prioritizing. And so it sounds good, but I'm not sure it is the most effective way to go. Now, the net result of what we do in the end will be at least a 10% cut across the board. There's also some things you can't cut. We're in this catch-22 now with federal economic stimulus funds. There's a term known as maintenance of effort. if we cut certain areas of government, like public education too deep or higher education too deep, we then risk losing all the federal economic stimulus money that's come down. So, you know, it's a Hobson's choice.
Senator, what do you think of some of the budget alternatives that Governor Schwarzenegger laid out today?
I think that the governor's tone was the right one, and I think that his general presentation of the alternatives was right on. But I note a couple of things. Number one, we're a co-equal branch of government, and though we're going to move quickly, we're going to negotiate and debate and do all that we can to take some of these cuts and to minimize their impact. Number two, I think it is really noteworthy that while the governor himself said, no new taxes, we're not doing taxes, about half of his budget solution are one-time solutions, not real cuts. $6 billion loan from the private markets, otherwise known as a RAW, you'll read it, Revenue Anticipation Warrant. It's basically a $6 billion loan. He wants to borrow $1.9 billion from local government, which we have to repay within 3 years. He wants to accelerate the way we take money out of people's paychecks so that we get the money, tax money, faster. And I'm not saying that those are not the right ideas, because they may be given the range of choices. But even he is acknowledging in his presentation that you cannot make $20 billion worth of actual cuts and have that be acceptable or palatable to the people.
Another proposal from the audience, with K-12 education consuming a significant portion of the budget, it seems the most logical place to cut. When I grew up, class sizes of 30 to 45 were common. Since research shows small class sizes are no better predictors of success than larger ones, why not cut one-third of teachers and pay existing ones a better wage?
I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question, that there is no evidence that smaller class sizes actually are a benefit to children. I think what the studies have shown is that what is more important than class size is the quality of a teacher, and nobody disagrees with that. But I don't think it's a good thing, frankly, to go from 20 to 1 to 35 to 1. I mean, all that means to me is that kids will get less attention from their teacher or a teacher's aide. And so what we did in February was we gave the school districts a significant amount of flexibility around class size. Basically, we said you have to follow the law, but we dramatically reduced the fines for failing to do so, which meant they can do pretty much what they want. Now, do people – well, we did it on purpose. I mean, we wanted to keep the principle of the law in place, but we wanted to give them the flexibility to be able to use the money that they get for class size reduction on whatever they needed to, because they're cutting budgets as well. That was the theory of the case. Now, should we go even farther? Should we eliminate any penalties and just say you have any class size that you want in grades 1 through 3? I'm not ready to go there. I mean, maybe as we sit down here and we look at how terrible these numbers are, you know, we may need to consider something like that. But I don't like the idea of taking first graders who now get a good start with 20 to 1 and putting 35 kids in a class. And I'm all for paying teachers more money, by the way. I think they're underpaid public servants by and large.
Here's an audience question that follows up on that point. Opponents of these ballot measures from both the right and left have been accusing the legislative leaders, you know, yourself and Governor Schwarzenegger, of scare tactics, talking about what will happen if they fail. Exactly what do you think California is going to look like in terms of services next year if these ballot measures do go down?
Difference between resolving a $15 billion deficit or a $21 billion deficit, and the difference if I do my math correctly, is $6 billion. And the difference is $16 billion of lost revenue in years 2011, 12, and 12, 13, when there's no guarantee that by that time the economy will be fully recovered and robust again. And so what will California look like? I don't know. I mean, I know that if people have – Gray Davis said this on CNN, so I got to attribute my statement here. But he said something to the effect that, you know, if people think that the politicians have cried wolf for a long time, the wolf is getting pretty close to the door. And because the numbers don't lie. I mean, the numbers are they're objective. The numbers are objective. And so if the critics have a better way of resolving a 15, and if we lose a $21 billion budget deficit without causing great pain to public services that people depend on and that are our investment arguably for the future, then they need to come forward and state their case. So it's not a scare. To me, I like what the governor did today because, let's admit it, he did it because there's an election coming up in 5 days. So what? I mean, don't the people have the right to have all the information at their disposal when they go into the ballot box? They'll still make their judgment. And we'll still respect their judgment. But I, as a voter, I want to know what the potential difference is if I vote yes or I vote no. And now they have that.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking tonight with Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Senator, a couple of weeks ago we talked on the phone about this election, and you've talked here tonight about some of the direct impacts, the fiscal impacts, if these ballot measures go down. But you also made an interesting observation to me about another cost if the state's fiscal crisis deepens, about all the other issues that are going to be pushed to the sidelines, and be interested in your observation
about that. Sure. Well, that's how I started my talk tonight because, you know, I ran for office and ran for leader to build positive agendas in California, like I have had the opportunity to do and succeeded to some degree when I was a member of the Assembly during some better times. We have a water challenge in this state. Not just a supply challenge, but a conveyance challenge, a water quality challenge. And we're working hard as we are dealing with this crisis to try to bring forward major water legislation before the end of this year because we're in our third year of drought and farmers are suffering. And, the water issue is very, very real. But if we are mired in this budget issue for a long time, it, you know, just by definition makes it more difficult to succeed on an issue as large as water. I want to, you know, I talked a lot. My thing about elective office is you always have to have a cause, you know. Mental health was my cause in the Assembly. And we ended up with Prop 63. Now my cause is this dropout rate because I find it to be a striking symbol of not only a failure of our failure on behalf of too many kids, but the failure of our ability to create an economy in this state that's robust and vital. We're letting too many kids fall off the end of the earth, and we're suffering for it, but hard to get to, again, if we're mired in crisis.
Senator, this minor miracle that you described when the Big Five, yourself, the other leader from the Republican leader from the Senate, the Assembly leaders and the governor came together to come up with this compromise over 8 weeks. If these ballot measures go down, is there a chance, or even if they don't go down, can that minor miracle be recreated considering what's happened to some of the Republicans who participated?
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, because look at the signal that was sent. If you're Dave Cogdill and Mike Felines, who put your state ahead of your own ideology and your own, you know, and your own political future. I mean, you know, I must tell you, these are two gentlemen who we could not be more polar opposites in terms of how we view the world, how we view politics, how we view the role of government. And I have the deepest respect for both of them because of what they did. And, you know, they lost their leadership. They lost their leadership, which, you know, in some ways, maybe they're relieved. But in another way, I mean, that's a big blow. And so the signal that it sends then to other Republicans, you know, about stepping forward and voting for a more balanced approach, it's a major concern. You know, I think it only solidifies the right wing, frankly, in a way that is not healthy or good for California.
An audience member suggests that unions have a stranglehold on education and prison policy and disproportionate influence in the state legislature. First of all, do you agree with that premise, and do you think that cycle can be broken?
I think that special interests across the board sometimes get too powerful. And so I think there's some truth that underlies the question. But look at this particular situation. You know, I used to work in my early days before I got into politics for SEIU. I was a labor attorney. And SEIU has largely been a political ally all of my political career. And we ain't getting along that great right now. They are on the other side of this thing. And we're vehemently opposed to what we did. But we did it. And so, you know, part of the art of governing is being willing to disagree with your friends. Because you know what? Interest groups have an interest. We have the responsibility of considering all of California. And there is a difference. And, you know, it's okay to disagree. So I think, yes, I mean, interests on all sides, on the business side too, have too much influence. And, you know, we could have a whole conversation on money and politics. But I think this latest chapter is a reflection of the politicians, you know, being willing to say no to many of the interests in order to get the job done.
When you talk about coming up with a more stable system of taxations, one of the numbers that we hear a lot from Sacramento is the fact that the top 1% of income earners, basically 114,000 returns plus or minus in the state, pay almost half of all personal income tax. Right. So is any kind of tax reform ultimately going to mean that the middle class is going to be bearing a heavier burden?
Probably. I mean, there really is a conflict, at least at the state level, between our desire for progressive tax policy and stability in our tax system. And how we reconcile that conflict as we look at restructuring our tax system, I think, is going to be critical. I still think we maintain progressivity. But I think we need to, frankly, diversify our revenue base to a greater extent. Maybe it shouldn't be 50%. Maybe we need to look at the other potential sources and either create new sources and or increase the other sources, not rely so much on the personal income tax. But it is a conflict.
Let me pull out a question that gives you a break from all these gloomy fiscal questions. Senator Steinberg, do you have any higher political ambitions?
Well, not today, I'll tell you. You know, I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm not going to be one of these coy politicians say, well, I don't know. Yeah, sure. I love what I do. I've been now in my 15th year of public service. I think I've been pretty good at it, pretty effective in terms of actually getting things done. I hope I've done it honorably. And I would love to continue doing this. What that looks like, I have, you know, if I win re-election next year in Sacramento, I represent Sacramento, I have the potential to serve 5.5 more years in the Senate and 5.5 years more as leader. And so I don't know, you know, what it would be beyond that. And, you know, it's also possible that after that period of time, I might say, time to do something else in life. My wife would probably like that, actually. But we will see.
As you know, the Commonwealth Club is a good forum to announce those types of things.
That's right. I have no announcement to make tonight, except we're going to solve this budget problem.
Thought we would try. Here's another question back to fiscal matters. If aid to local government is significantly reduced, what will happen to those cities and counties who have already experienced huge declines in property tax revenues due to the drop in home values? And certainly they are also have the added burden of it's very difficult for them to raise revenues.
It's a great question. And if we do borrow $1.9 billion from local government, which we have the right to do, I think it's twice every 10 years, we have to pay it back within 3 years, that would be a terrible decision. And it may be a necessary decision. Because the question is right on. Cities and counties are strapped themselves. You know, I'm not a scare tactic, but you might see some cities and counties go bankrupt. You really might. The state won't go bankrupt. You might see some cities and counties go bankrupt. But it also, the second part of the question, also speaks to the need to bring government closer to the people. I always make this pitch. You know, one of the impacts of Prop 13, Prop 218, is that if county board of supervisors or a city council want to raise a special tax, in other words, they tell the people, this is exactly how we intend to spend your money, which is what the people want, right? More detail. We want to know how you're going to spend our money. It's a two-thirds vote. If you don't tell the people, can we get some water for a woman right there? It's okay. All right.
There we go. Not a problem.
You're welcome. It's one vote. Here we go.
Anybody
else need water?
It takes more than that for some of the folks here.
Anyways, so if you're specific with people, it's a two-thirds vote. But if you want to raise a general tax, you don't tell people how you're going to spend the money, it is a majority vote. And how many measures have failed at the local government level getting more than 50% of the vote, but less than two-thirds? That ought to be reversed at a minimum so that local governments can invest in, you know, the areas where the public has said, we want you to spend more on public safety or more on healthcare or more on education. So the local government piece is very disturbing. And will not be good. But given the numbers, it may be necessary.
Senator, are you or your colleagues working on any measures to stimulate the private sector, either in regulatory relief or other ways to get business rolling again in California?
We did a number of things in February. First, on the tax side, we provided a $100 million tax credit for home builders to gain, I believe it's $5,000 for every home, $10,000 for every new home sold in California as a way to sort of spur the housing market. We provided some significant tax relief to the entertainment industry in Southern California because so much of that business, which, by the way, is not just actors and actresses and high-paid people, but a lot of craftspeople and people who do the stage sets and the lighting and that sort of thing, a lot of that entertainment business is fleeing to Canada and to other states. We also provided a $2,000 a person new hire credit in California, and we made it easier for the biotech industry, which I know is a big Bay Area industry, to be able to locate in California instead of another state. We also provided significant relief from the California Environmental Quality Act when it came to a number of the state-approved transportation projects that we wanted to get going faster than they would have had we followed through on every aspect of the environmental review.
And so we did do a whole host of things to try to spur the economy, but not enough. And I'm not sure that as a state we could quite do enough. I mean, you can't forget, again, we parallel in many respects what's happening nationally. And so, you know, what Obama is doing, what President Obama is doing, I think still provides the best hope when it comes to economic recovery for California.
Here's a question from an audience member who thinks every incumbent in the California legislature should be voted out. Can you give this person a reason not to?
Well, I hope that this conversation tonight maybe makes you realize that, we are a product of the people. I mean, it's very easy to say that, we are something other, but we really are products of the people. You know, I started on the city council in Sacramento. I'm a parent of two kids. I shop every weekend in the grocery store. And we're elected to do jobs, and we're imperfect. And sometimes we really screw up. But I must tell you, I'm proud to call myself a politician. I really am. I mean, I think it's a very honorable profession. And I've seen a lot of great things get done, too. I've seen great things get done on behalf of kids. I've seen great things get done on behalf of people living with mental illness. I've seen great improvements in the foster care system. I've seen great, an enhanced protection for the people who pick our agricultural produce, the farm workers in the state. I mean, the glass may not be half full, but it is not completely empty either. So I respect your opinion, whoever asked that question, but I'm not cowering. Here answering your questions. Get up every day, do the very best that I can, and I think that's true of the vast majority of my colleagues as well.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for just one last question, so I will ask it. What is your prediction on what's going to happen next Tuesday, Senator?
I mean, I'm one of these people who, believes the only real poll is the poll that's taken on Election Day. And I still think we have a fighting chance, especially when it comes to Prop 1A and 1B. C, D, and E, I wouldn't stand up here and tell you that there's a great chance. And I'm not sure there's a great chance for 1A or B either. In all likelihood, the propositions will go down. And I think that will be very unfortunate if that occurs. But if it does occur, we'll respect it. And we will get back to work fixing what we were hired to fix. And so, I would urge you to get out and vote yes on all the propositions. But regardless, I'd urge you to just get out and vote and to be loud voices for your own definition of change, because you don't want to leave it all to John and Ken and the other money-making wackos who too often dominate the public discourse. Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Daryl Steinberg, President Pro Tem of the California Senate. I'd also like to thank our audience both here and on the radio. I'm John Diaz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than one century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.
Great job.